Welcome to It's Bloody Complicated, the Compass podcast that brings you conversations from across the progressive movement. During the show, we speak with writers, thinkers, politicians, journalists, and campaigners about how we come out of these unprecedented times in much better shape than we went in. I'm Frances Foley, your host today and Deputy Director of Compass. Compass is a place where people come together to create the visions, alliances, and actions to be the change we wish to see in the world. We're interested in the how of political change as much as the what, and we think conversations like these are a great place to start. Compass members can join the call live and can put their own questions directly to our guests. If you'd like to be part of it, go to action.compassonline.org.uk/podcast to join Compass today. Otherwise, sit back, grab your drink of choice, and get ready to get complicated. So, without further ado, I'd like to welcome Oliver Berkman. Oliver is a writer, journalist, and a self-described productivity geek. And for over a decade, Oliver wrote a weekly column in The Guardian called This Column Will Change Your Life, which had big claims, but definitely had me hooked for a long time. And he's recently published best-selling book, 4,000 Weeks, Time Management for Mortals, distills a lot of this wisdom from his decade spent writing this column. Interrogating questions of productivity, time management, but actually delving much deeper into time and the meaning of life. So without trying to overclaim once again for this 1 hour, which I'm now like hyper aware of time management on this call that we have, I'm just going to say one more note about why we've got Oliver on tonight. And that is because last year I was struggling a little bit with balance and in general having too many things to juggle, work stuff and personal things. And I read Oliver's book at a very particular juncture, and it was extremely, extremely useful to me. And the reason I say this right off the bat is this is how Oliver came here to be here tonight, because I passed on the book to our director, Neil Lawson. He also read it, was also enthused, and reached out to bring Oliver onto the podcast. And to just, without overhyping the book, what I think is really great about it, and this is to you as well, Oliver, is just that for those people who are interested in questions of time management and in fact forced to confront with them just in the term, you know, in the day-to-day life, I feel like it's not enough to dismiss it, but also, you know, if you take any forays into that wonderful world of productivity life as you have gone where, you know, none of us, like many of us, fear to tread, I think the real point about this book is that it takes some of that seriously, but the answers are so much better than anything I've read before, which often sort of swings wildly between missing the point, you know, overinflating capitalism, and to a large extent, kind of not taking seriously some of the philosophers and the thinking that has gone before. So I really recommend this book as a kind of grounded in practical reality, whilst also not stepping away from some of the more, you know, philosophical and sort of ponderous questions that might come up for all of us when we think about time management. But to start with, I would like to start how we traditionally start with call, which is to say to Oliver, where are you and how are you?
I'm in Park Slope, Brooklyn. We moved from here to the North York Moors almost 2 years ago, but then I'm back here for 3 weeks for various different administrative reasons, really. It's extremely boring. But so I'm now back where I did used to live and not where you are, but I'm usually where you are. So it's very confusing. How am I?
Swinging back and forth.
I don't do this very much anymore, actually, but the sort of transatlantic thing, but you're catching me during it now. How am I? I'm a little bit frazzled. That's probably not a brilliant advertisement for the material, is it? Although I'd be interested to talk about that, the strange assumption people make that I must have achieved perfect enlightenment on these issues. Yeah, I'm a little bit sort of all over the place and underslept and things like that, but I'm really happy to be here and I really love talking about this stuff. So,
and one of the things I would say for your book is that what distinguishes it for me from a lot of these other productivity books is it actually doesn't claim that you're some sort of enlightened guru who has achieved a 4-hour work week, or, you know, naming no names, like that, where it just feels so far away from people's reality. It's I think quite, your tone is very humble and exploratory, which is not, you know, it's how most of us come to it, feeling kind of totally baffled and often very underslept and frazzled. So I think that's
People don't, I mean, maybe this is just me, but I think it's pretty universal. Like, you can assume that if there is a book that purports to offer advice or be like have wisdom in it or anything like that. It's a document of that author's struggles with this thing and their attempt to sort of write the guidance that they needed and couldn't find anywhere else. So the whole of like nonfiction publishing is basically a record of people's specific issues and screw ups and problems. Mm-hmm. Stuff that you don't struggle with is not interesting to write about.
Absolutely. So jumping off there, my first question is about actually precisely this. And it's a question really framed around the idea of control. So the book is called 4,000 Weeks because that's the average human lifespan.
Ish.
If you live to 80, if you're lucky enough to live to 80, that's what the number of weeks you can expect to have. And I think you go into quite a bit of context setting for that. And maybe the point where a lot of people get to is kind of how alarming that is, but also maybe clarifying. And the question for me is a framing around sort of control. So I have just been on holiday for 2 weeks and I came back and was immediately thrust from one quite different state of being in my head into another different state of being, which required me to have more control over my time, to get things done, to coordinate with colleagues, to make sort of, you know, ambitious and sometimes complicated things happen. Mm-hmm. That's necessary and important. But what kind of struck me on coming back, and especially in preparing for this podcast, was that actually one of the insights of the book is that the problem comes where this need for control maybe outstrips the necessary handle on our lives that we have, or overestimates our ability to actually have control and becomes an end in itself. So you strive for more and more control, which is how people get into this productivity world and why people come there seeking more control. And perhaps the problem is the control itself. Would you agree with that? I.e., sort of the premise is productivity systems promise more control, but actually just make you addicted to control. And can you tell us about how you came to realize that yourself?
Yeah, I think that is really, really well put. I mean, I think that sort of idea, you presented the control there as maybe a continuum, like sort of going too far. I tend to think of it as two different kinds of control or something. But I do think that at the heart of what draws people to things like time management and productivity advice, although it draws other people to other coping mechanisms, is this desire to sort of achieve a kind of, yeah, I use words like mastery or sovereignty or something over your time and your life. That just isn't something that humans get to have, right? Because it would be, we're sort of diving into the deep philosophy stuff first, head first, but that's probably for the best. It's like, that to have that kind of control over your life would be to somehow sort of get out of and on top of your life and to be in charge of your relationship with time in a way that you can't be, firstly, because eventually time is going to win the struggle sooner or later. And secondly, because you don't even really have control over the time that you do get, right? You just have one moment after the next and you can't really know what's coming next and you can't really maintain much control over the future. So there is a kind of control that we can have, and I tend to then sort of use words like influence or agency or something, but I'm not particularly working in any conventional tradition there by separating the words like that. There's the situation in which you sort of want to be a god over your time, and you never get there because you can't. So it always feels like that's just over the next horizon, and maybe if you could just find, 10% more self-discipline or find the right productivity self-help book, you'd get there, but it's never quite there. And then there's the kind of agency or influence where you're sort of accepting the fact that there's always going to be too much to do, that you're never going to know what's coming down the pike, and yet you can sort of actually, precisely because you acknowledge that about your situation, then you can focus on making things change in the ways that you'd like them to change to the best of your abilities. That transition, which I think I'm still going through on some level, has been a very long, slow thing for me. There were some moments about it, and I do write in the book about a sort of intellectual epiphany that I had on a park bench not very far from here at all, actually, in Prospect Park in Brooklyn, where I was sort of deep in my productivity geekhood and I was more overwhelmed than usual by all the things that I had to try to get done that week, and I was just naturally doing what I would always have done, which is trying to figure out like what combination of you know, productivity tricks and scheduling and putting my social life on hold and like deciding not to take any exercise for the next week. All what combination of things would enable me to get done all the things that felt like they needed to get done by the end of that week? And just being incredibly powerfully struck by the thought like, oh, it's impossible. Oh, it can't be done. And just finding that incredibly liberating, right? Because you actually, it's just impossible. What that this kind of endless anxious attempt to get to it all makes no sense. It's not that you sort of cut yourself a break. It's just that it just dissolves. Like, how can you carry on? Like, you're not going to carry on fighting to, you know, I don't know, make 2 + 2 add up to 7 or jump 3 miles in the air, right? These are just things we don't expect to be able to do. And so, you know, that was only the start and it was only an intellectual epiphany. As I say, it takes me, for me anyway, I always figure things out conceptually very fluidly and then take years of agonizing effort and unpleasantness to sort of live into them. But that was a big moment because I think we are standardly trying to do something that is impossible. And of course, there are lots and lots of social and cultural and economic pressures on us to feel like we've really got to find a way to do something impossible. But if it's impossible, it's impossible. And you can, you better find a different way of approaching reality and overwhelm than deciding that you must do something that in fact you cannot do.
Yeah, and we'll come on to some of the structural and systemic, but I wanted to kind of hold back from jumping in there because I think that's quite a political frame and we will get there. And of course, Compass is a political organization, but I want to stay with this philosophical question just a little bit longer because I think I might have actually stumbled across this quote in one of your blog posts, but which I'm going to hash up now, definitely. But something about how actually some of the greatest insights are those which are also counterintuitive and feel counterintuitive. And so some of the things that are most sort of cognitively useful or philosophically important, I feel counterintuitive. And so your point about actually this discomfort that arises from acknowledging that what you've set yourself is impossible to do, actually from that flows quite a lot of really interesting thoughts, but also practical changes you might make to your life, which I think is really important to stress about the book. What I like about it is it charts a way between understanding the philosophy and the psychology behind this, but also recommending or suggesting meaningful changes that can kind of help you navigate this. And I think navigate is the right word because this will never be a solved thing. It will always be held in tension.
Right.
And so I wanted to bring it right up to date in terms of, I suspect that some of the reason this book has also been arrived at a very good time for people is we've been through a pandemic where discussions of time probably more so than any really in the last sort of preceding decades was really top of people's mind. You know, we went through this like absolutely bizarre globalized social experiment. And your book was, I believe, a part written or at least finished during the coronavirus lockdowns. And I'm interested in a particular part of the book, which is at the beginning, about how our ancestors might have experienced time and the idea of deep time, an idea which I'd never come across. And I wanted you to just briefly explain this term. And also, I wanted to ask whether you think that, you know, despite us maybe not being conscious of it, some of us maybe even had glimpses of that during the pandemic, which was kind of enticing and intriguing, like a different way of being in time.
Yeah, totally. I mean, as a sort of causal historical story in the book, I am sort of deliberately evasive on some level, because I'm not going to say that it's sort of like necessarily industrialization that caused us to think the way we think about time now, or that there's one way that's more obviously sort of natural and true. But I think it's very reasonable to look at all the problems that we have in our relationship with time and to see that they all depend on the notion that time is the sort of thing you could have a relationship with, right? So there's a duality. There's you and then there's time. And, you know, we're constantly seeking maybe to have a easy and peaceful relationship with time. We're feeling, it feels adversarial. We feel hounded by time, or like, you know, time is sort of oppressing us. And then you can see a lot of the standard productivity advice is kind of like how to flip that and oppress time instead, right? How to sort of dominate in this relationship. But that whole notion that it's something that you relate to is a conceptual overlay, I think, that it's very reasonable to assume that sort of industrial people by and large wouldn't have had. And I think there's anthropological writing on this to sort of explore it. There are certain parallels with non-industrialized people today, although that's always a very, you know, troublesome parallel to draw between the past and the present. This people just who do not need because of the lifestyles that they live, do not require this kind of mental overlay whereby they're sort of constantly mentally lining up their tasks against a conceptual schedule. They're sort of constantly thinking about, like, am I using this next hour as a resource, right? Even the very idea of time as a resource. If you live in what anthropologists have called task orientation instead of time orientation, where the rhythms of the day just emerge from the things that you're doing, obviously it tends to be people whose work is very closely connected to the natural world. You just have to move with the rhythms of sunlight and sunset and harvest and planting and all the rest of it. You just don't get to that point in the first place where you sort of invoke this idea of time, which I think, you know, another way of thinking about this is kind of it might be best seen as a sort of form of alienation or something, right? This idea that, like, that this thing which is just the medium in which your life unfolds becomes this separate thing that you then have to, like, try to dominate or be dominated by, and all the trials and tribulations that come from that. And so I think when I'm using the phrase deep time, it gets used differently by different people, but I'm talking about the sense of absorption in the present moment and the lack of feeling tyrannized by this external schedule or this sense of a resource, which I believe, and certainly not alone in this, like, would have been more close to the ordinary state of, say, a medieval peasant in rural England, even though their lives were in, like, 99% of ways vastly worse than ours, right? There's a risk here of implying that they just sort of living in a state of delight all the time, when they actually, you know, had horrible diseases and no modern dentistry and all the and endless war and all the rest of it. So it's this sort of depth of experience that comes from just sort of being where you are, instead of lining, you know, constantly triangulating, or whatever the right word is, yourself against this concept of your time. I totally think that's a one argument for what was going on during lockdowns, when people found something positive about that experience, often totally coexisting with all sorts of negatives. Partly just because a lot of those sort of temporal landmarks just sort of collapsed, and we didn't have commutes and regular working hours and school runs and all the things that sort of structure time and hold up that sense of time as a thing to be placated or grappled with or fought against or whatever.
And crucially, that was okay. You know, people were given permission not to do that.
Yeah.
There was no status or judgment associated with not using your time well. Just people realized how internalized that was.
Right. Right. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think there are other ways of understanding that sort of bittersweet upside to lockdown life, to do with, well, certainly in the States, I know it's different in the UK, but in the US, though, here in New York, where I was then, there was not the, I think in hindsight, utterly perverse focus on, you know, not being outside. And so I spent I spent far more time outdoors, just like wandering around the big parks here with our then sort of, what, 2-3-year-old son, than I had done in any previous year. So there was a connection to the sort of rhythms of and seasons of nature in that way too, and a sort of reliance on neighbors and certain kinds of positive stories that we encountered in that time as well. But yeah, all of it has, I guess, in common this notion of, like, putting aside this kind of corporate and bureaucratized and sort of abstract thing that sort of weighs on us, and having permission to live in the moments of what was unfolding, which is true both of the people who were just, like, kicking back at home with their laptops and having a sort of secretly nice time, and of the people who are like at the front lines, right? Because living in crisis and emergency is actually like that as well, in a very different way. It also takes away this whole question of structures and whether your life is unfolding as you want it to unfold, and just brings you into that moment of experience.
Yeah, that's really true. So to follow on from that, really, I wanted to discuss a little bit of like the context in which we're operating here. And I think one of the ideas which does come up as part of the book, but I think is sort of alluded to quite strongly by some of the topics that you cover, is this idea, which I'm kind of increasingly interested in, of chronocentrism, which is essentially the idea that it's a sort of psychological term in some respects, in which the thinker believes that we're living in an especially significant or sort of turning point in history.
Right.
And one of the quotes that I alighted on, which was particularly useful for this, is that you say in the book, quote, it's wrong to say that we live in uncertain times, necessarily, particularly uncertain. We're just currently very aware of it. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was a really important insight and we're going to sort of segue from this into sort of the political and social and economic reality of what we're living in. And, you know, I'm aware in asking this question, like, I don't want to perpetuate this question perpetuate this problem in the question itself. But it's sort of a particularly interesting time to talk about this, I think, because the question about the urgency of climate and action on climate and response to the climate crisis, whilst it is obviously scientifically true that we're living through a crucial window of opportunity for action on this issue, and I'm in no way taking away from that or the existential threat. But I also think it has a potential for us to kind of understand our perception of time as well. And I suppose my question, therefore, is, do you think bringing together our conversation so far with this question of what sometimes feels like just, you know, rapidity of change, but also speed and urgency that is needed to respond and to transition and adapt? I sometimes do think, perhaps counterintuitively, that slowing down our lives and our thinking on something like climate could help us actually speed up our responses at the collective level. And I wondered what you thought about that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's fascinating. I could go off in a million different directions. I'm certainly not any kind of expert on the specifically climate subject matter, but we're all living through it, obviously. So yeah, first of all, I think that idea of chronocentrism, I think C.S. Lewis calls it temporal chauvinism, which is another phrase that I always like, is obviously that's independent of the question of whether there are specific moments and crux points in history, right? You can, our natural bias to assume that we're living through one does not mean that in fact we're not.
We aren't living, right? Through
it. It could be possible. But
Gillian Rose says something beautiful about this. So Gillian Rose, a sociologist, I think about this quote a lot, says we're always in the broken middle, by which she means a very tiny number of humans will be at the beginning and at the end. It's not to say it won't be us, but statistically speaking, we're very likely to be in this broken middle of it always feels a bit broken and we're not at the beginning and not at the end. And I found that kind of reassuring and, you know, sort of somehow comforting.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that, you know, there's two, tell me if these are what you're getting at, but two things that just sort of spring to my mind. One is there is this kind of fallacy of arrival or whatever it gets called, you know, this idea that it's on us to, quote, save the planet in a way that implies that we have to sort of achieve and complete something in our lifetimes, or even just like on the scale of like this week or this year, whatever it is, that gets in the way of doing that thing, because it doesn't properly understand itself to be one step in a long chain going on forever. And it's not that this might not be a very intense or financially expensive or, you know, whatever it is, step in that chain, but that there is something lost when we just think about like everything was leading up. There's another kind of temporal chauvinism, right? The idea that history has been leading up to this moment, and it was all sort of just kind of a preparation for us to do this thing. And actually, yeah, I think so. Obviously, in certain ways, you can see how that sort of might work against a proper concern for future generations.
Or a humility of what our ancestors have gone through that might actually equip us with. And sometimes when I'm talking to people from other countries, and actually, to be honest, even in the States, sometimes I think there's more of awareness of like where we've come from, maybe because they're quite a new country. So a lot of them are aware of their origin stories in terms of their backgrounds and their cultures. And And I found it quite grounding for them to talk about their ancestral inheritance. Like, our ancestors have been through stuff like this before, even though they haven't necessarily been through this before.
Right, right, right. Yes, exactly. And understanding, it's dangerous stuff to talk about, and depends, it feels like, but like understanding the sense in which one might be overestimating the emergency is important too, because precisely because, you know, it's psychology of alarmism and things, right? That these things can paralyze people if they feel like it's something that humanity probably isn't at all equipped to handle. That can lead to less action. Mm-hmm. This is making me think, it's a whole separate thing, let's not go there, but this is making me think of the very sort of extreme wing of the artificial intelligence doomers, the people who think not that it's going to wreak a lot of havoc, but that it's going to sort of end life on Earth. And I think you see in that it's a sort of a religious vision rather than a more practical one. And it doesn't lead to people being capable of taking action, right? It leads to despair.
But precisely on that point earlier of maybe taking you right back to the start of why we do things that are impossible, what's interesting about that is what that actually, maybe sort of ironically for AI lovers, tells us about what it means to be human. Why do we look for some bigger, you know, why do we want to be at the end or the beginning? Because we want agency. And actually we have more than we think, you know.
Right. It's demeaning somehow to just be some like person in the middle of the whole sequence. And then I think, you know, there's a whole other aspect to this, which I do go into in more detail in the book, about patience, the idea of slowing down to the speed at which things take. And there's a very obvious sense there, I think, in which, you know, I don't know if it's specifically right in any given context of environmental crisis and campaigning and coalition building and all the rest of it, but like, it absolutely can be the case that you get somewhere quicker by going slower if it's a question of bringing people on board at the rate that it's possible to bring them on board, instead of just
if you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go together. That
right, yeah, exactly. And so, you know, that it's very hard to judge when you're in that kind of situation, but it's certainly the case that in all sorts of contexts, I'm thinking usually about this in the context of like some work challenge of mine or fixing some broken appliance in the house or something, but it does, I think, scale right up to the very biggest societal challenges. There definitely are contexts where it is just more effective and quicker to go slower. And then just quickly throw in as well, there's a bit in the book where I talk about the environmentalist Derek Jensen and his writing about hope and how hope can actually be a problem, how feeling like, you know, it's all on the next generation to try to rescue us from this situation, or we've got to persuade the government the governments of the world to rescue us from that situation, is actually disempowering. And leads over the long term people not doing the things that they could do for the earth and for the people on the earth, just because they love the earth and the people on the earth, not because and animals and biodiversity, not because they've figured out how this is going to lead to a future conclusion that they feel needs to happen.
So I'm gonna ask two more questions. For the people out there who are sitting with your question, and especially if you want us to, you know, bring it right back down to earth for you, and maybe there's something you're specifically dealing with, either in your political world or even in your personal life, that you kind of want some, I'm inviting you to kind of ask for some insight or wisdom on this particular issue, because I think this is a question that can feel so large and enormous and abstract, but also just feels so mundane and day to day, because we're dealing with this question of time management all the time. So I'm going to ask you two more questions, Oliver. And the first one is hopefully like a little bit of a challenge one. So for political actors and activists, the idea that we might kind of cultivate more acceptance to what the future holds. So your quote around, you know, the spiritual leader who said, you know, I just sort of don't mind what happens.
Yeah.
Is particularly challenging for all the reasons we just discussed. And probably why it's therefore so necessary for us to hear or for people involved in politics to hear. But my counter challenge would actually be that sometimes when I read stuff like that, I think, well, if I think back through history and think about good lives, not judged necessarily by the well-being of those people, but the impact that they had on the world for current generations and for future generations, I look to some of those individuals who've done the most to kind of make our societies more peaceful, just, you know, healthier, fairer. they haven't always been people who've been good at accepting whatever happens. And yep. sometimes at the cost of their like personal happiness, but arguably to our greater, for greater gains for the rest of us. You know, Angela Davis says something like, I'm done with accepting things I cannot change, and now's the time to change things I cannot accept. And I think about that tension quite a lot in sort of activism. How do you come at this from the perspective of sort of people who are dedicated to trying to make the world better however they can? How do they find that balance between acceptance and commitment to a cause? And just in parentheses, I would say, for those of you out there who do know about the psychological approach to this, which is called acceptance and commitment therapy, I found a lot of synergy with that and your book, which is about saying, accept where your limits are, but commit to the things that you want to spend your life, you know, devoted to.
I mean, the first thing, there's a couple of things. One thing which I'm just sort of parroting 1,000 meditation teachers, but it does need saying, is that, you know, one way to pass this is to point out that acceptance does not need to mean resignation. That acceptance refers to accepting that things are as they are, not that things must therefore stay as they are. It entails recognizing how much effort we put, I think, usually into denying to ourselves that things are as they are. And that's totally true in the context of time, right? Because one thing I'm tracking through this book is that all the ways in which we try to make ourselves feel like we're not finite and we're not limited and we have all the time in the world. And actually accepting that is the precondition for changing things that can be changed. And I think the parallel sort of, you can lift that up and move it into social political change and say that, you know, if you're not able to look with clear eyes on the way that things are and the resources that you do have and don't have and the state of public opinion as it actually is, then you're not going to ever get to those changes. So I would say that, you know, all the sort of great figures in history who've made those changes, they have absolutely not like rested easy with things that they wanted to change, but it's come from a basis of like actually seeing where they stood and who was already on their side and not, and the situation that they were in, rather than sort of telling themselves stories about that. And then I guess it's turning into the same point. I said it was 2 points, but it's like, I think that commitment and acceptance, as the name of acceptance and commitment therapy suggests, are not, things you have to sort of balance or find a line between, but they just go completely together, right? Because it's in accepting. So again, I'm thinking about this in terms of personal time, but I think it can be applied further afield. Like, in order to properly commit to using the time that I have, say today, to do a few things I'll be glad to have done and will have made a difference somehow, I have to first of all accept the finitude of that time. If I don't accept that, I'm going to sort of strike off as I did day after day for many years of my early adulthood, somehow believing that I was going to sort of get through everything that was on my plate, and then getting through like half of one of the things that was on my plate. So I think that sort of falling back into reality, that real acceptance is, that's how you grapple with the reality and change the things that you can change. Which is not to say that there aren't plenty of people, and maybe arguably whole religions at certain times in history, who've used acceptance as a sort of quietist, you know, sort of a way to not engage. I think, you know, meditation retreat centers are full of people doing what's been called spiritual bypassing, where they sort of use spiritual practices like, and talking about acceptance, to sort of not confront things in their own lives that they do need to change. So they definitely can be used in this way, but
or also to build sort of collective social political power, be like, you might be in a happy zen-like state now, but are you going to use that to actually have an impact on the world to make other people's lives better?
Right,
you know?
Right. Now, the reverse happens too, which is people getting really, really righteously involved in big political movements to avoid
that is
addressing
fair.
to avoid addressing their personality problems. But I think, you know,
we all know some of those.
Again, it's all avoidance and confrontation or not, you know, it's like, yeah.
So for both of those, the answers is acceptance and commitment, and some need more acceptance and some need maybe more commitment,
right,
you know.
Sure. Yes, exactly, right.
Hello, Samuel here from the Compass office. I hope you're enjoying the discussion so far. It's Bloody Complicated is brought to you by Compass, and it's made possible by the support of our amazing members, like Eliza. Here's Eliza on why she joined the Compass community.
My name is Eliza. I've been a Compass member for about 3 or 4 years, I think. What drew me to Compass was the fact that it's cross-party and it's also not a party. I had a light bulb moment about elections, which was no one's going to win except the Tories under this system, and we have to work together. Having been previously a member of the Labour Party and then joining the Green Party, I really wanted to see parties working together, and we have people that are politicians, MPs, trade union leaders, etc. And it's quite level. There's no big hierarchy. It's quite an honest, open space where people come together. You will hear from people from all around the political spectrum actually debating the hard stuff. It's actually, let's find a solution to the problems that we have and let's do it together. We need this progressive alliance. And I would like to see people who are passionate about getting the Tories out in the next election and getting proportional representation in. Come and join Compass now and actually swell the movement, because without people, there's no power. And that's what we need right now.
Find out more about joining the Compass community at compassonline.org.uk/podcast. And now, back to the discussion.
So I have one more question, but before I ask it, actually, I'm going to go to the questions that we've got in the chat, and I'm going to save my question right for the end, I think. So, Harry, we look like we've got some juicy questions, which, you know, as expected tonight, are going across a range of different things. Do you want to bring in some people to ask on the first round of questions?
Sure, yeah. So we've got Jonathan.
Great stuff. Hi, Jonathan. I think we've got you. Do you want to ask your question? Go ahead.
May sound a bit irrelevant, but I don't think it is. I go to church most Sundays, not because I believe in what the vicar has to say, but I quite like some of the hymns, and that's a week by week marker. But it strikes me, sort of half listening to most of the sermons, that there's not really a sort of facing up to the finite time. You know, the 4,000 weeks that Oliver talks about. I reckon I've probably got about, if I'm lucky, another 500 left. And it's all sort of, so it's looking towards the end, as Oliver's been talking. And so everything's postponed. So really you don't need to engage very much with the time you have on planet Earth. Mm. Because there's a sort of a vague offer of things that happen, that you're going to get something better in a sort of a later life. And it sort of strikes me that what Oliver's potentially sort of looking at is a more useful way of living than religions have sort of offered for the last so many thousand years.
Mm. I think that's a really fascinating point. Thanks, Jonathan. Should we take a couple more from the floor and then give Oliver the chance to respond to all of them?
Sure. We've got another one from Brian.
So a colleague of mine once said this, you know, when you're struggling at work, you need to think, does it matter today? Does it matter tomorrow? Will it matter next week? Does it matter next month or next year? Or will it matter in 10 years' time? Which is an interesting guide to whether you should do something. And it sort of behind that thought was encouraging you to see the difference between urgent and important things, which we get bedeviled with, especially with emails. But the problem with that is the other question, which is, we're always thinking we have to go in baby steps, because if you do a massive change, it's going to have unforeseen consequences, everything's going to go wrong, and the amount of time and effort it takes. But, you know, your vision for a better society is actually a long way in the future, and it's quite complicated, so we have to go in baby steps. So the question then is, how do you know that the baby steps are actually, you know, steps in the right direction, and what your actual destination might be? So you need to be you need to have that sense in order to answer question one. So that's it.
Good question. Okay, good question. We like a question in two parts. Have we got one more, Harry? Just complete a like cost me round of three.
Sure. Yeah. I have, well, it's a fairly long one, but I'll just read it out from Terry. Or let's see if Terry's interested in asking the question.
Yes, I am.
Brilliant.
Well, I was just remembering an experience I had a few years ago when I was completely overwhelmed by my to-do list and I just couldn't prioritize. And eventually I thought, oh, sod it, I'm not going to do any of it. I'll just have a day off and do what I feel like. And then by the end of the day, I realized I'd effortlessly whizzed through the whole list.
Yes.
And I have no idea how that happened or how I can recreate it. But I just wondered if your description of deep time and staying in the moment might be relevant to understanding what I stumbled on then. So any insight that might help me recreate that experience would be very useful.
Oh, we love this, Terry. I could see that Oliver was champing at the bit to answer that question. So Oliver, do you want to come back on those comments and questions? Thanks to
I was scribbling notes here because I'm sufficiently frazzled by all the things that I've been doing that I'm working.
Just dive in. Don't worry about it. I'm sure you'll answer all of the questions.
The first question about was it from Jonathan? Again, certainly people's names I'm not going to remember on this basis. It's like a mean trick to give me like multiple and have to keep them.
You've not learned the politician's test of saying.
Right. One of many reasons I'll never see obviously not going to claim that I'm saying something more useful than all major world religions, but I do think that that idea of eternal life has been interpreted in sort of radically different ways at different points in religious history. And if you are interpreting it as like you don't really need to worry about the finitude of this one because an eternity of a very sort of linear nature is assured in the next one, and I think that has been certainly one kind of interpretation, then yeah, you can totally see how it sort of leads to a devaluation of meaning, even if it's true, right? It's like if it's not true, then it's a huge deception, and if it is true, it's still causing you to not make choices in the optimal ways and the most sort of reality focused ways in this life. There's a book that I'm sure some people in the audience will be aware of called This Life by the I think he's Swedish American philosopher Martin Haglund, who I quote a bit in the book, and who especially relevant to this audience maybe in that he sort of goes into all these. The first half of the book is all about this kind of, you know, the finite nature of human life, and then in a way that I'm not sure I personally find completely convincing, he seeks to derive from this the case for democratic socialism as the sort of most human acknowledging way to the sort of the way that the form of political organization that most accurately recognizes human limitation and finitude. And I find the vision of it quite inspiring, but the connection to the earlier part is where I might have my arguments. I suspect that somebody who was committed to a very different form of politics could make a case for their form being the one that that is truest to human finitude. But certainly that notion, you know, it leads very directly from our limited control over time and our limited, you know, the way we just find ourselves where we are in time and can't control what happens in the future and can't take credit or blame for the place that we emerge from. Like, this does lead to a lot of rather obviously sort of you know, community focused, perhaps socialist focused, but certainly sort of looking out for each other as the sort of basic necessity, just because we are in this limited state where you can't expect any human to like sort it all out for themselves, and therefore it doesn't seem moral to punish them for having failed to do that as a result of accident of birth or accident of personality or anything else. That second thing about wanting to know that you're right, thinking about putting things in the context of the far future, I write about this in the book under the label of cosmic insignificance therapy, and the idea that it's actually really liberating to sort of get over yourself and realize how insignificant each one of us is in the grand scheme of things, not in order to become sort of, you know, depressed and unable to do anything, but precisely to like free up action, because you don't need to be quite so concerned about whether a given choice is the right one or not. You can just sort of get stuck into stuff without that. But then at the same time, Brian was contrasting that with the idea that if you're going to make incremental changes, you need to know on some level that you are going in the right direction. You don't want to sort of go all the way in dismissing what you do right now as irrelevant in the long run. I think it's an interesting tension. I don't sort of immediately have any way of resolving it. One thing that I think is relevant here, and I don't quite know how, but I'll just throw it in there, is that I do think that in something I found very powerful in my own life when it comes to sort of being less troubled by overwhelm and anxiety, and it would be fascinating to think about how that would translate into the political sphere, is that there's something very important about the nature of one's intentions. And this is very important about the idea of not just striving towards a place of calm, if we're talking about personal time management, or justice and equality, if we're talking about political goals, but beginning from that somehow and embodying that as the person that you already are. So again, I haven't thought this through in the political layer, but for me, whenever I get into that mode of like, if I work really, really hard and drive myself hard, then I'll get to the point where I can relax, that does not work. That just reinforces driving hard and anxiety as the operating mode of my life. Whenever I can, and it's not always, but whenever I can be like, okay, I'm just going to start from assuming that these things can be done, or what needs to be done can be done, that there is enough time for what really matters for me to do. And I'm going to relate to the infinity of possible things to do from that place. That is the one that is successful. So I wonder if there's something to be learned on a political level there.
Just to jump in really briefly here, yeah. I read this beautiful thing the other day about the definition, the distinction between destinationalists and directionalists. And right. I thought that was really beautiful, that like some people are really very, very focused on the destination, and some people just are kind of moving us in the right direction. And in fact, direction has a lot more sanity to it, given the law of unintended consequences. We don't know what's going to happen, but just keeping moving in this direction. And also because mean shape ends, you're likely to go in the direction you want if you focus more on the direction rather than the destination, which I think feels true both on a personal level, but also Compass would argue, this is why we call Compass, obviously, that also is a good kind of political strategy.
Right. And on the sort of historical political front, the thing that springs most readily to mind, obviously, is, I'm sure it's occurred in many other instances, but you think of the rationalizations made in the history of kind of Soviet communism, right? To get from A to B via all sorts of means that were completely unrepresentative of the people who'd started off at A, and all this kind of stuff. And I think that the way that means shape ends is maybe that's just a simple way of saying everything that I've been.
Barbara in the chat is helpfully bringing me back to my pluralist self, which is that we also need both directionalist and destinationalist. And you're dead right, Barbara. It's maybe just a matter of emphasis, and maybe lens in which you look at things rather than with people themselves, you know.
And when you're talking about your own individual life, maybe you need to be both in some way, right, as well. The whole sort of multiple inner parts kind of thing. And then, I just really like Terry making this great point. It reminds me of points made by the meditation teacher, Susan Piver, about how it's so easy for us to sort of drive ourselves into thinking that we have to do all sorts of things. Obviously, on some level, we have to do certain things to sort of pay the rent or be minimally responsible parents. But like, there's an existential level to it, which turns into this kind of tyranny that we then resist, because we like, people don't want to be oppressed, even when the person oppressing them is themselves, and or the version of themselves that drew up the overly demanding schedule earlier that day. And it's incredibly subversive, certainly for me, and I think for a lot of people with my broad kind of similar personality or whatever, to actually dare to ask what you would like to do with a given moment of time. And as I found talking about this, it gets very sort of bound up and confused as well by our sort of modern arguments and discussions about privilege, because, you know, obviously I am in a very fortunate position to even be able to ask at 9 a.m. on a Monday morning, like, of the things on my plate, what would I like to do now? But at the end of the day, like, if you have the option of harnessing that force of desire to actually do things, coming up with a whole system for doing them that systematically squelches that motivation is just, it helps nobody. It doesn't help you. It doesn't help the people that you're serving through your work. So I think, you know, anyone who feels they can even slightly afford, just experimentally, just for a day, just for an afternoon, to just see what would happen if they stopped driving themselves to complete a certain list of things they think they must do and just sort of decided on the basis of intuition and where the energy was, it can be so illuminating. And yeah, mm-hmm. you end up doing all those things that need to be done. You do not end up just, like, you know, eating ice cream and surfing social media or whatever. You really, you know, if something's important enough for it to feel like a responsibility, then on some level, you probably want to do it as well.
It's the fear that's holding you back from the thing. Is that's the oppression. That's the classic procrastination machine, isn't it? The thing that's holding you back is actually the fear of the thing itself, rather than actually the fear rather than the thing itself is often
yeah right back. Right, absolutely. And yeah. You know, all this stuff, all these kind of things, people are, there's a sort of a macho approach to productivity and to creative production and stuff, this whole notion that you know, inspiration is for, like, wusses or something, and your job is just to, like, put your backside on the chair and get to it. And it's like, there's a truth to that somewhere, but it's like, why go around squelching what you're inspired to do? Like, at least see if it leads you in the direction of some things that...
We rarely got to better things or learn that much by forcing ourselves to.
Right, you know, right, exactly. Yeah.
I've got one more great question that's come in the Q&A, and it's from Tom. So, Harry, I wonder if we could get Tom to ask a final question from the floor.
Yeah, I'm just bringing him in now.
Yeah, hi, Francis. Hi, Oliver.
Hi, Tom.
I'm afraid I haven't read the book, but...
You are forgiven.
The discussion so far has been quite a lot about sort of individualized time management. I mean, I understand the book's not totally about that. And it's been Compass. I mean, I'm quite interested in big political issues around time and control. And I wondered if you have in the book, or you've got thoughts now about what the major social or political levers that might be available to that we can pull to improve, as it were, our relationship to time. I mean, obviously, in the past we've had controls over working hours, 8-hour days, and so on. Are there any big, broad political shifts that you could envisage that would improve our relationship with time?
And just to tack on the end, the reason I brought you on, Tom, is because I think that is a very good question, and it also links handily to the question that I was going to ask to finish, which is exactly that. But also, I was thinking very much in the direction of, so at Compass we have looked a lot at questions like universal basic income. We had a campaign for a long time which was housing Compass until recently for universal basic income, but also questions of, like, care, thinking about, you know, people who are caring and social care and how we approach that question. We've also looked at things like slow food, slow TV, slow travel, you know, the slowing down the pace of things. And finally, just throwing in there, you know, citizens' assemblies, deliberative democracy relates to my question earlier about slowing down in order to speed up, sometimes to take more people with you to harvest the experience and wisdom of a broader sense of the population will take time. And famously, citizen assemblies do take quite a bit of time. Deliberation is rarely something that's done at speed. So to tack on to Tom's question there in a cheeky way, I wondered, yeah, what are the big sort of policy things that you seem to be sensible at least to explore if we're trying to reset our relationship to time? And reset our relationship to time for, as you alluded to, more people to have that freedom.
Yeah. It's really interesting. And I think it does touch on some things I've thought about and written about. I feel like it would be more honest here to not try to turn these into policy proposals, because then I'm sort of really in a world that I'm just be bullshitting you, really, to think that I know that. But there's two things that spring immediately to mind where this is really relevant, and then maybe they feed on to specific policies. One is obviously inequalities of discretionary time and inequalities of margin in life. And one of the things I was sort of quite determined to do in this book was to make it be about the universals. And there were a couple of points in the editing where people tried to suggest that I should, you know, spend detailed time talking about in the book, or detailed word count in the book, talking about how the experiences of time were different for people on sort of demographic basis and socioeconomic basis. And like, I just had a really strong feeling that that's not this book, not that it's not really important, but it would just be like, I would just totally be sort of making it up and paying lip service in a way that wasn't helpful. There's lots of really good books, several I can think of, on that broader kind of topic. And then the other one is to do with, so that comes from, that comes from the way that, like, if you remove all the barriers on how time is apportioned, if you don't have sort of fixed things when it comes to working hours and sort of welfare systems that enable people to step back from work in certain ways, but also if you don't have like old religious traditions and people observing the Sabbath through social pressure and religious belief every Sunday or every Saturday or whatever, what happens in that space, you know, the economic system just, and capitalism, just work just floods that space, and people will be the victims of their time being depleted sort of differentially based on how much they have the individual resources to put up those barriers. So, you know, yeah, it does all point towards kind of you know, top down kinds of interventions that I am personally feel a bit ambivalent about. I'm not sure that the sort of, to the extent that they were ever true, I'm not sure that the stories about, you know, is it French businesses not being allowed to send emails to their employees after a certain time of day and things like this, I feel like they're definitely double-edged swords. One of the extraordinary parts, then, the second thing I wanted to mention is just to do with the synchronization of people's time and how important it is for fulfilling lives, for meaningful political activity, for all sorts of things, that we're sort of, that we not only have some spare time, but that it's the same time as the people we want to be working with. And I sort of track in the book a bit how we've just become sort of totally desynchronized from each other. Some people, because they're on kind of algorithmically generated schedules in retail work in the US or something, for example, but other people who are very privileged, and like people like me who get to sort of make decisions about our own time and sit doing interesting work at laptops, it's still completely impossible for me to like make a plan with two other friends to meet for a drink, let alone meet to have a sort of political meeting, because like we're all just completely on separate schedules. We have too much freedom in some sense. And there's amazing research about how in those countries where there remains a tradition that summer vacations are like the same 3 or 4 weeks of the summer every year, people seem to be a lot happier.
And including the retired and the unemployed people. That was
right. Including people. Right. Exactly. Yeah.
I was like, it doesn't matter if you're right, not the person who's directly benefiting. It benefits everyone.
Right. And it's actually long been known that it's long been found in some surveys and studies that people in long-term unemployment are happier at weekends than weekdays, because this is all about the sense of social pressure and whether you're doing something that marks you apart from other people.
Some of them, anecdotally, from my friends, were happier in the pandemic because everyone is in the same boat. It's just shared experience. Yes. Like, we all need more shared experiences. Yeah. That was part of what was happening in the pandemic. People had more shared experiences.
Yeah.
And I think politically that's very powerful.
Right. And again, you know, there's two obvious directions that you can go if you want to have more of this like social regulation of time. And one is top down and start to say that, like, you know, everybody has to be off work at certain times, or you at least incentivize the system to create more of that. And then the other is the kind of conservative tradition based approach, small c conservative, where you say we should be seeking to encourage more and more people to work and to live in rhythms that are lined up with each other. And, you know, again, all sorts of benefits and all sorts of very, very severe problems with the kinds of cultures where nobody's working on a given day of the week, where everybody's, you know, at home at the same time and at work at the same time. And it tends to then be, you know, there are all sorts of inequalities that arise then. So I'm not being very good here in terms of coming up with a...
You are, because in a true Compass fashion, you're being extremely nuanced, which is a little bit, a bit of this and a bit of this, and on the one hand and on the other hand.
But even just understanding this dimension, right? I mean, and even just seeing that, like, a very large amount of the time when we say or think that we want, you know, wealth, money to be distributed in a different way, like, what that actually cashes out into is the time we have to be present for our lives. Yeah.
100%. Well, Oliver, in true Compass fashion as well, and also very thematically, you know, very topical, we're about 3 minutes over time, which is not uncharacteristic, but I wanted to say a huge, huge thank you to you for your time, not just tonight, but also the time that you spent writing the book and preparing the book. I really encourage everybody to read it. I would say, maybe because I love getting into the abstract and talking about the philosophical, our conversation tonight has been quite philosophical, but I also want to stress that the book itself ends with, I think, a very clarifying and sanity-inducing list of principles, which you'll be happy to know I, like, copied out by hand and gave to my housemate because I thought she needed them, about how to come at this. Like, if she didn't have the time to read the book, irony of all ironies, read this list that's extremely helpful to you. She has actually now also read the book and said it was very much worth her time. So I would say do read the book. Also, you can subscribe to Oliver's twice monthly, something like that.
Yeah, roughly.
Which is also great. I'm also a happy subscriber to that. And a huge, huge thank you to Oliver for coming tonight, and to our questioners. Thanks to Harry for the moderation and making sure everything runs smoothly. And sorry that we did run 4 minutes over time. I hope there were 4 minutes well spent with us on the podcast tonight. I wanted to remind you all that Compass can only do this kind of thing because we're a membership organisation. And so what makes all of these things possible. If you like what you've heard today, please do recommend other people to be members, share this around. And when this comes out as a podcast, you know, anyone can listen to it. So please share with your friends. You can tweet at us at Compass Office. And also, important announcement that in the spirit of what we've been talking about, we're actually taking a podcast break over August because some of us are on leave, and we're also regrouping to think about our lineup for the months ahead. But in September, we'll be picking back up with podcasts planned around New Zealand and their shift from first past the post to PR. So we're going to have some New Zealand experts on the show. And also we've got a program lined up on the politics of the far right and how we should be taking that into account when we think about progressive alliance building. But finally, a massive thanks to you, Oliver. A massive thanks to everybody on the call here tonight. Please do read 4,000 Weeks, and please do make, you know, good choices about how you use your time, but also don't be oppressed by those choices. That it's the calm and the sanity that I'm giving to you all this evening that I think the book really helpfully brings focus. So thank you, everybody,
thank
very
you
much,
everyone.
And enjoy
thank
the
you.
Rest
thank
of
you
your
so
Tuesday evening.
If you like what you heard today and want to be part of building a much more equal, democratic and sustainable future, then visit us at compassonline.org.uk/podcast. Plus, you'll be able to join us live on future calls like this one. You can tweet Compass Office or email francis@compassonline.org.uk. If you enjoyed this week's episode, please give us a rating. It will help us reach more listeners in the future. After all, it's only fair they know it's bloody complicated too.